problem. The Army began offering war counseling to returning troops after several soldiers at Fort Bragg killed their wives and themselves after returning home from the war. As the alleged architect of financial schemes that led to Enron Corporation's demise, former Enron finance chief Andrew Fastow could become a bountiful source of information for federal prosecutors, according to who are building their cases against his superiors, legal experts say. According to the Associated Press, Fastow and his wife Leah are to plead guilty this afternoon to charges related to their roles in the 2001 collapse of the once envied energy company. Two sources speaking on condition of anonymity said an impasse that erupted last week over a judge's refusal to give Lee Fastow only 5 months in prison was resolved. And finally, a bipartisan committee of state lawmakers will be created to determine if Governor John Rowland should be impeached. Speaker of the Connecticut House, Myra Lyons, made the announcement after meeting with the governor in his office for 45 minutes. Lyons says the special session of the House will be called to adopt a resolution to establish a committee of inquiry. And that concludes this edition of the WBAI Headlines News. I'm Dred Scott Keyes, back in 55 with more news headlines.
Thank you, Dred. And again, you're listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM at 5 p.m. today. Mr. Kaku will be on with explorations, and at 3, you will have talk back with Hugh Hamilton. At 2, you will have Fred Geobold with Light Show. And at 1, Harmon DeMille with Positive Mind. And now, until 1 o'clock, you have here in studio with us Dr. Kamal Kokai and the Global Medicine Review. Welcome to this January 14th edition of Global Medicine Review. I'm your host, Dr. Kamal Kokai, and I'm joined here by my good sister, Angel Warrior, Fabian Miranda.
And good morning to everyone, sending you peace, light, and love.
And I'm also joined by Danette Beam, acupuncturist and herbalist, and good person.
Thank you. Good morning, listeners.
Okay. Well, today I think we have a very interesting 2 hours prepared for you. I think we also need to backtrack a bit because we're trying to really initiate this project around what we've called a community dreamscape, or another way to look at this is a community vision quest, in which we're holding out the possibility and reality that as a community of listeners, we are connected in a way that is more than just you listening to my voice or just listening to BAI, that there's another level of connection that's there that we can touch upon, that we can realize. And this level of connection is something that can actually be experienced. It can manifest through our dreams. So what we're proposing is that as we move forward, there are going to be a series of seed thoughts for people to take into their dreams, and we're going to see what results from that. And it's not going to be surprising to have people actually have the same kind of dreams. And for those of you who feel that you don't dream, we merely ask that upon going to sleep, you just repeat over and over to yourself that you are going to remember your dreams. You'll see how simply that works. And the initial thought that we put out there just for people to take into their sleep was the question, what can I do to make a difference in the world at this point in time? I'm going to say that again. What can I do to make a difference in the world at this point in time? And we appreciate the response we had to the program. A lot of you are dreamers that have kept track of your dreams over the years, so we had a flurry of information, but we're trying to focus in a specific area. And next week we'll probably introduce another seed thought that has more of a community focus. And I think later in the program we'll share at least one of the dreams that that came across our email, or I think this one was on voicemail. Well, with that said, we want to move into today's programming. You know, we spend a lot of time speaking about medical systems and different ways to perceive and treat the body. It's really fascinating being in a position as a practitioner and having the opportunity to work with people in ways that are both a challenge to your own spirit and also challenge the other person as well in getting them to take more responsibility for themselves, but also helping them to realize and reconnect to a part of themselves that generally they've neglected. You know, part of us being ill is that we tend to ignore the signs that we're getting in our life that something is wrong. And we don't really go and seek help until we're in dire straits. So there's a whole piece of being a participant in this revelation that people go through as they try to regain their health. And also the part of just being open as practitioners to understanding different cultural expressions, not just in terms of what your where your client is from or their background, but also healing systems that have evolved around the planet that in many instances are of better service to you and your client than maybe the tradition that you've actually been trained in. And of course, one of the biggest joys of being a practitioner is to actually see people get better, and to see people get better in a way that allows them to move beyond your care, allows them to actually see how to take care of themselves. And, you know, this commonly comes up in just showing people how to detox their bodies and how to take care of their bodies in a way that they remember that their grandparents did, but they've kind of lost that knowledge and being caught up in modern existence. Well, one of the biggest challenges for practitioners and people living in this society is to move away from that frame of mind that dissects our reality in such a way that energy and matter are separate, mind and body are separate, and spirit as being, a spirit is actually separate from the material. While we rarely acknowledge matter, body, and material, the idea of spirit in all of its different associations, whether we're talking about energy, chi, prana, or even God, have not really carved out a place in the meaning in the collective consciousness of the population as it relates to health care and maintaining health. The truth is that you're just not going to heal anyone unless you're working directly with a person's life energy. And that means a lot of different things to different people. It means different things in different cultures, as we'll find out later. You might remove some diseased tissue with surgery, but that really isn't healing. Healing is what the body does after you have removed the diseased tissue, or what the body attempted to do prior to the surgical intervention. Now, while practitioners might have their own religious or spiritual beliefs in working with a client, this is more to inspire the practitioner and to serve as a reference point for their relating to the client, translating these spiritual beliefs into a viable clinical model is an entirely different matter, especially if you practice medicine, and especially in dealing with all the different places that people are coming from. How do you carve out a model that recognizes spirit, but at the same time doesn't alienate people because it seems foreign to them? You know, it's really difficult for doctors to say God and medicine in the same sentence or even the same paragraph. But, you know, in the doctor's office, those realities actually exist. Spirit has to be acknowledged within any kind of healing environment. There has to be some way that a practitioner brings that into that environment. Now, if we move out of the physician's world and into the world of health practitioners that use, let's say, as an example, touching as a primary method by which they derive information from a patient, here we might look at different pulse taking in various Asian forms of medicine, but we also have craniosacral therapy and cranial osteopathy, not to mention touch for health. Now, when someone's involved in a medical art that involves touching, this accesses a completely different part of the practitioner's mind and spirit. For one, the practitioner is directed within themselves. And tapping into, let's say, the craniosacral rhythm of the client, they're resonating with a part of themselves and the patient that's connected to various emotional and spiritual realities that aren't really accessible to mainstream physicians. In fact, practitioners of various touch therapies can get so caught up in the emotions of a client and lose the sense of grounding that actually you'll find a more mechanistic approach to medicine. So what I'm pointing out here is that each medical art has its strengths and it has its weaknesses. It has its window where it's really clear, and then it has a window where it's really foggy that represents its biases. To really deal with clients in a holistic fashion requires that we transcend the limitations of whatever discipline that we've been trained in as a practitioner. Actually, you know, patients, they'll gravitate toward a practitioner that has a model of healing that's more consistent with their own worldview. Or basically just because they've been told, hey, this guy got me better, this woman got me better, go see them. But this is all kind of unconscious, that connection that forms when a patient walks into a practitioner's space. So as practitioners, we need to be able to meet a patient where they're actually living at in their spirit. Let them know that we're competent to address their problem, and then help them to see the larger picture that the issue is related to. For example, if someone has irritable bowel syndrome, they're having terrible, let's say, spasmodic pains in their abdomen, you have to be able to show them that, yeah, you can help them deal with that spasmodic pain, but, you know, they may not be ready to really accept or hear that this problem is related to a stressful lifestyle or the different emotional imbalances that they have, maybe even with a single individual, or that the problem started because they couldn't digest a particular emotional issue that occurred early in life. So these are realities that have to be approached. We've always tried at Global Medicine Review to highlight the numerous gates through which we can actually perceive the mysteries of what's going on with a person when they become ill. And in general, people associate a physician's diagnostic acumen, the symbol is the stethoscope. The truth is that there are really far more sophisticated ways to find out what's going on with a person, methods that not only tell you about the person's present state, but ways to look at past events and to actually see the imprint of these past events on a person's body. Many physicists feel that the nature of the universe is holographic. Well, certainly this is the case with the human body. By holographic, I mean that the basic pattern of the body's economy is repeated in smaller bioenergetic representations of the body, in the same way that it can be argued that the human being represents a microcosm of a much larger reality. These microcosms within the body have basically been ignored by the allopathic medical profession. Examples of these microsystems include the representation of the body on the iris, known as iridology. Then there are holographic representations of the body on the ear, the tongue, the abdomen, the feet, as in foot reflexology. There's even facial diagnosis. Now, if anyone, this is another area we're going to shift into here, because if anyone has ever watched traditional Indian dance, and I'm also reminded of various Ghanaian dances, the movements of the hands and fingers carry a world of symbolism. But beyond the symbolism are various energetic circuits or seals represented by different finger and hand positions. These are called mudras in the yogic tradition. Each of these positions are associated with an inner state which can actually be discerned with a little bit of meditation. Now imagine a feeling that comes over you when you ball your fingers into a fist, or you hold up a middle finger to someone. Or perhaps you're familiar with the Jhana mudra, in which the tips of the thumb and fifth finger are brought together, a posture known as the wisdom seal, and is employed in various meditative states. This mudra in particular is also therapeutically used to overcome insomnia, nervous tension, and a weak memory. In fact, within ancient tantric traditions of Indus Kush, there are a number of therapeutic mudras that are documented. For instance, the prana mudra is recommended in the case of a heart attack. It's performed by pressing the index finger down on the mound of the thumb, with other fingers pushing pushing against the index finger. So what's suggested here is that these different finger and hand positions actually change the energy and physiology of the body. Now let's flip forward to the 20th century. In the Western world, we have the discovery of clinical applied kinesiology by George Goodhart. A strong muscle will become weak when the body is challenged by what it registers as a noxious stimuli. This can be a thought, it can be a touch to a diseased area of the body, or some undesirable stimuli or potential allergen being held against the skin. Dr. Goodhart, its founder, is still practicing and researching and presenting seminars, and he's well into his 80s. In fact, when I was at a seminar of his a couple of years ago, he was talking about his last ski trip. So he's a good proponent for his system. In fact, the magnitude of his clinical discoveries have really yet to be properly heralded by the world, although any patient that's come under the care of a practitioner who has facility in this area with applied kinesiology will really be spoiled, and they'll have to marvel at the diagnostic and therapeutic accuracy that can result from applying the system. Also in the 20th century, we had the emergence of cranial osteopathy and cranial sacral therapy, where there's an appreciation of the movement of cerebral spinal fluid around the spinal cord of the body and the expanse of the brain, a fluid whose movement has its own rhythm, which is separate and distinct from one's respiratory and circulatory rhythm, capable of revealing deep disease patterns in the body to anyone who actually has the skill to palpate this rhythm, a rhythm that can be discerned in practically any part of the body from just touching. This is really an awesome skill for anyone that takes time to master it. And there are actually workshops that are taught around the world. There are workshops that are taught by our guests who we'll be introducing in a minute, as well as the Upledger Institute, an institute that's played a major role and revitalizing this diagnostic and therapeutic system. Understanding and appreciating a craniosacral rhythm represented by a disease state affords a practitioner the opportunity to correct this rhythm by adjustments that are really barely even appreciable to the naked eye. We're not talking about gross chiropractic kind of adjustments. Now imagine bringing these systems together, craniosacral therapy, the reality of mudras, and the clinical acumen of applied kinesiology. While mainstream medicine is trying to make up its mind about how much it wants to recognize these Trojan horses that are in its midst, many practitioners are taking these core systems, refining them to further suit their needs and creative impulses and revelations. In fact, our guest incorporates principles of Chinese medicine and homeopathy in its practice, as well as providing a unique philosophical approach that draws on Islamic culture to provide a foundation for appreciating health and healthcare. Our guest, Dr. Solihin Tom, will be introduced in just a minute. I want to share with you one other consideration. It's the concept of modeling. And you've often heard me say that a system of healing can be no better than the model of reality that uh, of the model of reality and humanity that it subscribes to. The modern medical model leaves out so many important realities of human existence that it's frightening, and basically the therapeutic outcomes in many clinical areas speak to this. Many ancient cultures have presented models of reality in the form of what the Western world calls mythology. Within sacred mythology of cultures around the planet, metaphor is the currency by which one's spirit comes to appreciate great truths. This came up last week, of course, when we talked about the nature of dreams. Metaphors and mythology are the language of the spirit and clearly require a different kind of intelligence to perceive their relevance and applicability. Models of medicine rooted in spirit are more transformative in nature and allow us to deal with the changing realities around us. And I think this will be clear when we actually talk about application of the model that we're going to discuss in the second part of the program. So today we're going to go on this little journey with the founder of a system that integrates some very important threads to make it a truly multidimensional system of care. Dr. Tom, are you with us?
I am. Good morning to you.
Good morning. And I'm just going to read some brief introductory information about yourself, and we'll move into our discussion. I think we took this from your book, and I'm just going to read part of it. Solihin has always considered himself to be somewhat of a rebel, which perhaps can be attributed to his eclectic upbringing. At the age of 2, his family moved to Cyprus and then to Kuwait, where they lived up until he was 18, a brief spell in Beirut followed by boarding school in Scotland. Fueled the nonconformist within him. His sense of being an outcast coupled with a hunger to know himself took him through a self-destructive stage from which he emerged as he made his own rites of passage while traveling through the Middle East, culminating in 2 years in Afghanistan. These pivotal years shaped him as he pondered his feeling of emptiness and the apparent purposeless nature of life. Slowly, his adventurous spirit found its mark, and he went to osteopathic school, studied homeopathy and acupuncture in the United Kingdom, and practiced physical medicine in London. And I just want to say, as we bring you on, you know, a lot of young people actually go through just what you described in various forms. And unfortunately, the society really doesn't support many of them in a way that they come out of that so they can find what their true purpose is and actually be of service to themselves and humanity. Many of our young people are languishing in jails, or they fall short of what it is that they could be doing. So we're really glad that you found your mark and are here to join us today. And I guess I would start out by asking you, is there anything else that you would like to add just to, by way of introducing yourself, so that people have a sense of where we're going to go with this conversation?
Well, yes, thank you. I think I'd like to sort of start with the idea of those lost years. When I was sort of traveling around the world, looking for, of course, myself, but I was looking outside. I constantly was distracted and seduced by all sorts of things out in the world, notwithstanding the sort of free use of drugs in the sort of early 60s. But what really happened to me was that actually at some implicit level, I started to recognize that there was something deeper inside me that actually would give me the answers. And I guess this is sort of strength of my genetic coding in that I, and like most of us, come from some sort of religious background. In other words, in our DNA we contain the sort of longing to find our mark, to find our connection back to God. And I guess that was really what was happening with me. As I sort of looked for myself, I slowly started to listen to what was inside me, and I started to recognize that there was a guide, there was a connection, there was a hotline, if you like, towards the Creator. But it didn't just come by itself. It was all those years of preparation, all those years of being in the dark, in the sort of being lonely and disconnected and not sure of who I was or what my purpose was. And so it came slowly. So the thing that I can share is really that if we have some implicit trust that we're here for a purpose and with a greater sort of life process that's going to go on, then if we wait and listen to ourselves, the information and the reality of who we are and what we are starts to sort of manifest. And it may be slow. It may take a long time for us to blossom like a flower. And that's slowly what actually happens with me.
So I know you, in London then, you were in studying cranial osteopathy.
Well, I studied osteopathy, and then when I graduated, I realized that cranial osteopathy was the sort of thing that I really leant towards, and so I started doing that as a postgraduate work.
Perhaps you can just say something about that, because maybe people have a sense of what that is, but, you know, they might be a little foggy about what does a cranial osteopathic doctor do.
Certainly, yes. Well, first of all, osteopathy in England is slightly different from osteopathy in this culture in the United States. It's much more parallel to chiropractic, actually. It's the idea that we look after the physical body, and the idea that the physical body is like a house, and that if a house is upright and erect and all the structures are vertical and horizontal, that all the doors and the windows and all the sort of bits and pieces in the house actually work properly. Well, a body is just like that when we're disorganized and our bones aren't aligned and our hips aren't leveled, then basically the sort of piping inside us becomes disorganized, whether it's the nervous system or the cardiac system or whatever. And so osteopathy is really looking at the physical structure of the body and making sure that it's functional and works properly.
So so you started with a very biomechanical orientation.
Absolutely. And what actually happened was that I had my first child when she was born, wonderful birth, but left my dear wife rather depressed. So she actually had postnatal depression after the birth. And I probably complained to one of my teachers, and he said, well, why don't you bring her in? So I did, and he held my wife's head, Alicia's head, and shut his eyes and didn't say anything for about 20 minutes, and then looked up and said, good, come back next week. And I suppose she had three treatments, and all her depression and discomfort after the birth disappeared. Her sort of cyclical depression that she often had when she was a child completely disappeared, and she was really a completely different woman. And this extraordinary process sort of caught my eye or caught my imagination, and he didn't say anything really about what he'd done.
Right.
But that sort of taste, in a way, was quite seductive, because over the years of osteopathic school, I was always drawn to the idea that, gosh, there's this other mechanism, this rather silent mechanism, this unseen thing that we don't really notice is actually going on all the time. And it's a harbinger of equilibrium, of homeostasis, of the ability to right the body when it's actually dysfunctional. So I went and did cranial work, and what this is about the body is said to be really fluid, and that what we say as osteopaths is that the body has this rhythmical expansion and contraction of a sort of fluid rhythm right through every tissue of the body. And when this fluid system is working appropriately, then all the tissues function and sit and are aligned in their proper relationship. And when that happens, then there is a sort of well-being and a dynamic of the body that permeates us, that makes us feel good and that actually allows us to be functional and right. And what that really means is that when we hurt ourselves or we get ill or when the vagaries of life, sort of when we come up against those things, that our body is in such a harmonious place implicitly inside us that actually we're able to weather the effects of a fall or the effects of the flu or whatever, and we get over these little minor transgressions very easily. And so it supports our dynamic in health, which means that when we get sick, we get out of being sick. When things are difficult, we pick ourselves up more easily than not. The difficulty is that in life, the sort of forces or elements around us, the sort of things that can affect us, whether they're seen or unseen, in other words, a blow or a bash or a car accident or a flu or a bug or someone's remarks to us, when these elements affect us and therefore they have a force, that force then influences the fluid system in the body.
And that
then affects our own health and our well-being and our capacity to sort of pick ourselves up when things are difficult.
Dr. Tom, we're going to take a brief, I think, 30-second break or so. This is Global Medicine Review. You're listening to Dr. Solahin Tom, and we're talking about a system of healing that we're about to introduce here. We'll be right back.